From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a practicing Catholic takes a critical look at his church. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gary Wills. In his new book, Papal Sin, Wills examines the church's positions on birth control, the ordination of women, and the celibacy of priests. He concludes that many popes have seemed unable or unwilling to admit the mistakes of the past, and in fact are compelled to justify them. Also, a former member of the Squirrel Nut Zippers, Tom Maxwell, he wrote and sang their hit, Hell. He has a new solo album that some people describe as neo-swing, a description he hates. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's been another shakeup in the Gore campaign. Campaign chairman Tony Coelho is out, and Commerce Secretary William Daley is replacing him. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Coelho said that he's leaving the campaign for health reasons. He's currently in the hospital for an inflamed colon, and Coelho has suffered several epileptic seizures over the last year. A friend who saw the former congressman on Sunday said that Coelho felt that right now was a good time to go because the Gore campaign has been able to close some of the gap in the polls with his Republican opponent. Coelho was also the subject of continuing ethics investigations into his financial dealings when he was the director of a U.S. exhibition in Portugal. His replacement, Commerce Secretary William Daley, has impeccable credentials in the Democratic Party. His father and brother both served as mayor of Chicago, and Daley has a reputation for rescuing difficult legislative initiatives for the Clinton administration, including NAFTA and permanent trade relations for China. Now Daley will see if he can do the same thing for Vice President Gore. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Shifting winds have forced firefighters and homeowners to flee before a wildfire that's burning not far from Denver. Several hundred homeowners who'd been evacuated from the area were trying to check on their homes, but were ordered back out of the area this morning as wind gusts drove the fire toward them. The fires blackened about 6,700 acres and destroyed at least a dozen buildings. Firefighters say it's threatening another 200 houses. A second wildfire has destroyed 36 houses southwest of Denver and forced the evacuation of more than 800 people. Federal regulators are expected to approve the merger of Bell Atlantic and GTE, perhaps as early as today, creating what would be the largest local phone company in the U.S. That's according to published reports, including a story in today's Washington Post. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The FCC, in agreeing to approve the merger, would give its blessing to creation of a telephone giant. Valued in excess of $60 billion, the deal would combine the one-time baby Bell and GTE, a regional telephone company based in Texas. A merged company would have 63 million phone lines. It would also have a far larger wireless business than its nearest competitor. Scott Cleland is an analyst with Legg Mason.
The game is scale. This is Clash of the Titans. This is Land of the Giants. And so the other telephone companies that are not as big, I imagine, will and need to get bigger.
Under terms of the agreement, the merged company would reportedly be required to spin off its internet business. However, it could reacquire much of the operation if it opens its local markets to competition. The new company, called Verizon Communications, would have more than 250,000 employees. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 27 points to close at 10,715 in moderate trading. The technology-heavy Nasdaq gained 48 points to close at 3845. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court of Canada has rejected a challenge to the Canadian government's 1995 gun control legislation. The Firearms Act requires every gun in Canada to be licensed and registered. Lee Carter reports from Toronto.
The case argued that private property is a provincial, not a federal matter, making the regulations unconstitutional. All nine judges unanimously rejected this argument. Even before this new law, Canada already had strict gun control rules. In stark contrast to the US, only a few handgun licenses are issued, accompanied by long waiting periods and cumbersome registration. All automatic weapons are banned outright. This new act now requires the registration and licensing of shotguns as well, a move that has angered rural farming communities, but supported in general opinion polls and by the police. As a concession to those who oppose the legislation, Canada's Justice Minister is making a number of changes. including dramatically dropping the cost of a gun license. For NPR News, this is Lee Carter in Toronto.
Moderate Republicans and Democrats in the House have defeated a measure that would have curbed President Clinton's ability to create new national monuments. The vote, 243 to 177, handed a victory to the administration and to environmentalists. This year alone, President Clinton has set aside more than 1 million acres of land in 5 western states to create 8 new national monuments. Republicans say the designation of national monuments is the prerogative of Congress and not the president. The measure would have prevented the administration from using any money to design, plan, or manage the monuments that have been designated since January. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gary Wills is one of the Catholics who stays in the church in spite of his disagreements with the church's power structure and its insistence on upholding positions that he says no longer make sense in the modern world. In his new book, Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit, Wills looks at the history behind several of the church's positions. He argues that in order to justify their positions, popes have misinterpreted scripture or let others coax them into disingenuousness, such as when Pope Paul VI said that the ban on contraception was for the good of the church. Will says that Paul's 1968 encyclical Against Contraception was one of the most disastrous papal documents. Gary Wills is a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of several books on American history, as well as a recent biography of one of his heroes, St. Augustine. I asked Gary Wills whether his perspective as a practicing Catholic guided what he chose to write about.
Yes, as a practicing Catholic, I have concerns that many people share over the fact that there's a vastly decreasing number of priests because of the celibacy discipline and other things like the condemnation of all forms of homosexuality. There is a total disregard for the papal teaching on things like contraception, where a large number of the Catholics polled say they just don't believe what the Pope is saying. The rate of abortion among Catholics is the same as among non-Catholics. So all of these things I've written about in various places, as have other Catholics. There's nothing in this book that I haven't addressed in some way, somewhere. But 2 years ago, when I came out with a book on St. Augustine, I came across again and read more carefully and with a much more benefit the two treatises on truth that he wrote. The occasion for both of them was the attempt by some Christians of that day to use deception in order to promote the gospel and the church. And he said that lying is never very good, but it is worst when it is used to promote the truth, that God is not served by lies, by distortion. And so I saw that all these questions that have been troubling people are not really disparate. It's not as if the Pope now really is a misogynist, an anti-Semite, a homophobe, or any of those things. He clearly does want to have much better relations with all kinds of people. But he has to draw back constantly just when he's opened a door and say, but of course, we've never said anything that was wrong about our relations in the past. The popes have always been right. It gets to the point where he just denies history. In apologizing to the Jews, for instance, constantly now, he seems to have apologized kind of nonstop for 2 years and more. He constantly says that individual Catholics, what he calls the sons and daughters of the church, have done things that were wrong in the past. But the church itself, by which he means the teaching church, the magisterium, the voice of authority, has never been wrong about the Jews. This flies in the face of history. You know, the medieval history is full of pogroms and other persecutions of the Jews, which were actively supported by the teaching of the church that the Jews were a cursed race. As recently as the 1930s, Pius XI said, there is a curse on this people because they killed Christ.
You say that the most crippling, puzzling blow to organized Catholicism in our time was the birth control encyclical, which was issued by Pope Paul VI. Why do you think that that's like the worst blow to organized Catholicism?
Yes, well, I'm quoting Andrew Greeley on that, but I think that there's a case to be made for that. You have to remember, first of all, that there's nothing in Scripture or Revelation about birth control, about contraception. It used to be thought that the Onan story applied to that, and that the papacy taught that for a while. It doesn't do it anymore because it's clearly not true. So what we have is a natural law teaching, according to the Church, and natural reason in people of goodwill and good intellect should be able to recognize that law. Well, Paul VI brought together a group of very well-qualified Catholics, theologians, family counselors, all of them loyal Catholics, men, women, lay, clergy, to study the problem. And these people, who were eminently qualified, who had been trained by the Church from childhood in almost all cases, looked at it honestly and said, we can't accept this. There's no valid argument for it. And the leaks out of that commission made people expect that there would be a change in the teaching. After all, why did he bring together these people? Why did he trust their expertise? But when the question went to Paul VI, members of his curia and some conservative theologians said, you can't say that your predecessors erred on this matter.
Why? Because popes are supposed to be infallible.
Yes, well, this was not technically an infallible teaching, but they were saying that it would be such a blow that you've asked people to make these tremendous sacrifices to have large families or to practice kind of psychologically crippling things like the rhythm method and have said that people have actually sinned if they didn't believe in this and gone to hell if they didn't believe in this. You can't say that all of that was just a mistake. Well, obviously you can because it was. But Paul VI, who was really a very humane, good man and did wonderful things, caved in under that pressure. And that's the pressure of a structure of deceit that I'm describing in this book.
What did he base his opinion on? I mean, there was a dissenting report that was issued. Who wrote that?
Yes, and he tried to argue that in the nature of things, sex is always meant for procreation. And if it's not aimed at procreation, then it's wrong. Now, that's the old Stoic teaching that was a part of late antiquity among Christians and non-Christians. But it's one that would, when you take it seriously, mean that intercourse between sterile people, intercourse after menstruation ceases, intercourse that's interruptus, masturbation, oral intercourse, intercrural intercourse, all of those things are equally sinful. And that's what the Church at one time did teach. In the course of time, it said, oh no, married people can have intercourse even when there's no chance that they're going to have children, because you're not actively intervening to prevent the procreation. But the whole argument that because the end of sex is procreation, therefore you can never use it for anything else, is like saying the end of eating is nourishment, and anything beyond the minimal nourishment of your body is sinful. Or having a meal just for the celebration of an event, having champagne rather than healthy water, all of those things are sinful. That's the parallel in natural law that he's trying to make. And that's what the commission said makes no sense at all. He went back to that old argument, and of course he didn't recognize that one of the reasons that the condemnation had arisen and been maintained for so long was the misinterpretation of the Onan story. He knows that's not available anymore, but he still sticks to the teaching that was partly based on it.
What is the Onan story?
That because Onan spilled his seed on the ground rather than practiced coitus interruptus, that the Lord was displeased with him. That was taken by the medieval exegetes to mean that he prevented conception, and any prevention of conception is wrong. Now Bible scholars realize that Onan had been forced to marry the widow of his brother to continue his brother's line, and out of jealousy for his brother's line, he refused to do that. So the sin was against the family hopes of dynasty, not a sin against procreation as such.
Now, the ruling against birth control is based in part on a belief in what's called natural law?
Yes.
What is that?
That the working of natural law is God's signal to us of the way he wants things to go. And that when you see, for instance, that eating is for nourishment, that you should take care to eat for nourishment. That's kind of common sense rather than any real doctrine of natural law. But it was taken by medieval theologians to mean that you could really work out a system of prohibitions and exhortations from the workings of nature. Very few philosophers accept that anymore. It's a very time-bound philosophy, and the papacy is kind of a last stronghold of it.
When did natural law originate?
Well, it originated with the classical Greek and Roman authors, as did so much of the Church's teaching. Much of the problem of the Church is that it accepted into its flow, historical life, things from antiquity, late antiquity, the Middle Ages, which were really extraneous to the gospel, were kind of sociological conditioners that were affecting everything at the time. And they were taken to be essential rather than accidentals, like barnacles on a hull of a ship. And sometimes they've been promoted to be the most important thing of all.
Do you think that the continued Catholic ban against contraception is putting practicing Catholics in the position of having to either lie or feel that they're sinning or feel that they have to be a Catholic and yet defy the Church at the same time? That it puts them in this kind of compromised position?
It doesn't so much compromise the layperson, because the layperson is just ignoring it and doesn't feel that he or she is defying the Church. They know quite well the difference between the papacy and the Church. The people who are compromised are the priests, who are told that they have to teach this. And that puts a strain on their integrity. Should they just be silent rather than teach it? Should they pretend that they're teaching it but not teach it? I know a priest who was not ordained because his bishop, I mean, he's not a priest, he's a brother, a Jesuit brother. The bishop said, you have to promise to teach that this is a sin, contraception is a sin. He said, well, I can't do that. He said, well, then you can't be ordained. But I think it's more likely that some people are ordained who make that implicit promise and have no intention of keeping it.
Gary Wills is my guest. He's a professor of history at Northwestern University, the author of many books, including his new one, Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit. And it's a critique of the Catholic Church. We'll take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Gary Wills. His new book is called Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit, and it's a critique of some of the papal encyclicals which are still followed in the Catholic Church. Let's look at the encyclical that priests cannot be married. Where does that teaching date back to?
Well, St. Peter, of course, was married, and he traveled with his wife in a missionary team. Missionary teams of husband and wife were very common in the early church. It is presumed that other people who are not expressly said to be married were also married in the disciples. Paul himself, who was not married and said he would prefer that people not be married because the world is about to end, was, according to most Bible scholars now, including very conservative ones like Raymond Brown, Joseph Fitzmyer, and others, was originally married and then was either a widower or separated from his wife. In the Jewish culture, it was wrong not to be married. And there's no reason to think that Jesus meant to affront that by choosing people who were not married. It was a duty to your family to be married. Priests were married in the Jewish dispensation. There was no idea that the ministry had to be celibate, and it wasn't until the Middle Ages. The way it became celibate is that in late antiquity, when there was a high regard for asceticism throughout the culture, not only among Christians but among pagan philosophers, the idea of self-denial, of transcending the body, of even torturing the body, became a matter of prestige. And the Desert Fathers, the great ascetics, became so famous for their holiness that people went to them to ask for guidance. They were the oracles of God, in effect. And the married priesthood became second-rate citizens in the Christian culture. And in order to catch up with the authority of the ascetics, they started adopting some of the ascetical maxims, including celibacy. So that idea grew gradually in the West and was finally legislated in the Middle Ages. But in the Eastern part of the Church, even that part which continued its adherence to Rome, it has never been a rule. So it's something that came and went in history and could go again, but the Pope has now decided that that's not the case.
Yeah, when was the last time? What has our current Pope had to say?
He has very strenuously upheld the encyclical of Paul VI that priests cannot marry.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the encyclical that priests cannot marry has also been based on certain beliefs about women and women's sexuality?
Sure. The teaching of the Church in the Middle Ages was very clear. It was derived from two sources. One from pagan antiquity, and especially from Aristotle, which thought that women were inferior. They were a mistake of nature, that if everything in the conception process had gone right, you would have a man. When it went wrong for various imagined physical reasons, you got a woman. And the other source was Jewish rules of uncleanness, that a woman could not enter the Holy of Holies because menstruation made her unclean. Both those were accepted into the Christian papacy in the Middle Ages. St. Thomas Aquinas said, God deserves the best only, and woman is second best in the species humanity, and therefore she cannot be a priest. That would be an insult to him not to offer the best that we have, the man. The modern papacy can't teach either of those things. They're too manifestly absurd to people now. And so they abandoned that and denied that they ever taught that, as a matter of fact, and went back to a fundamentalist scriptural argument and said, Jesus didn't ordain as priests any women. Well, there's a problem with that. He didn't ordain any men either. There is no priesthood in the New Testament. That's a development of a doctrine later on. And this is so strained and disingenuous and deceptive. And the only reason to do it is not out of some hidden animus against women, but out of this nervous fear that if we allow that the teaching of a pope can change, the whole structure of Christianity will collapse, which is, of Catholicism at least, will collapse, which is nonsense. The great saving truths don't have anything to do with contraception. The Church has changed on things like that, on usury, on celibacy through the ages. The great saving truths that have to be preserved are things like creation and the Trinity and redemption and the resurrection and the mystical body of Christ and the Eucharist. It's so sad to see these dramatic mysteries that are the part of the revelation that we were taught in our faith reduced to a matter of, you're not a Catholic if you don't agree with the Pope on contraception. That's the sad thing that I'm talking about in this book.
Let me get to another issue that you discuss in your book, and that is the ordination of women, which the Church does not allow. What are the reasons that the Church currently gives for that?
Well, they're the reasons I already gave, that it says that they were not ordained in the New Testament. And, of course, they deny the real reasons, the inferiority of women and the uncleanness, ritual impurity of women. The idea that women should just be handmaids, which gave us the nuns, for which I'm very grateful because they educated me and did it with great love and great skill. But nonetheless, that image of woman is so unacceptable now that nuns are disappearing. The approach then was that nuns could be nurses but not doctors, nuns could teach textbooks but not write them, nuns could serve priests but not come near the altar, And you know, that has disappeared so entirely in our modern world, and in other religions, by the way, which don't treat women that way, that the papacy is losing its credibility with some of the most devout members of the church, the women, who are not only half the human race, but usually far more than half of the people who go to church.
Now, you've said about some of the other encyclicals that are still upheld that you think it's more about maintaining the church's authority and consistency than anything else, that the church
That's
is afraid
right.
to say, oh, we were wrong, we made a mistake. Do you think it's the same thing with the ordination of women?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, and all of these things, you know, they are trying to overcome past attitudes. The church in the past clearly was anti-Semitic and homophobic and misogynist. And they're not that anymore, and they're trying to get away from that tradition, but they can't quite bring themselves to say, we were wrong. They think that the trust in the church will not last if the Pope says we were wrong. And of course, it's exactly the opposite. It would tremendously increase trust in the church if he admitted such things. And then it doesn't endanger the real deposit of faith, the truths taught in Scripture and entrusted to the church.
How does this relate to the subtitle of your book, which is Structures of Deceit?
It is that they don't set out to lie, and they don't set out to punish women or gays even, or people who marry who are priests. But the structure of their culture in the Curia is so self-defensive and self-protective that they slide over into evasions and distortions and suppressions. I liken it to a concept that St. Thomas Aquinas used. He called it ignorantia affectata, a cultivated ignorance, an ignorance that's so useful to you that you consciously or unconsciously or both are careful not to disturb it. You don't want to know the real truth about what was said in the past because it might embarrass you in the present.
Gary Will's new book is called Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide at www.alcatel.com. And from Random House Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, staying with the church in spite of his disagreements, we continue our conversation with historian Gary Wills. And we talk with Tom Maxwell, formerly of the Squirrel Nut Zippers, about writing new songs inspired by early jazz. He has a new solo album. We're listening to it now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with historian Gary Wills. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Lincoln at Gettysburg. His new book, Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit, argues that popes have often misinterpreted scripture or made disingenuous statements to justify positions that no longer make sense in the modern world, such as the ban on contraception and the insistence on the celibacy of priests. Wills is a practicing Catholic. You know, a lot of people say if you have such disagreements with the church, why don't you leave? Go to another religion or just stop practicing altogether?
I don't have any disagreement with the church. I have criticisms of the papacy. That's two different things entirely.
Is it?
The church, oh, absolutely, of course. The church is not the papacy. If so, we would be in sad shape. It would mean that only one person really had access to God, and then he told us what God told him. The Spirit is not granted to one person. It's granted to the whole body of the church. In fact, the Second Vatican Council defines the church as the people of God, not the person of God, not the people listening to a person, but the people of God. So I have no criticism of the church. The church I belong to now is a very loving community, a very active and intellectually questing community, much more socially active than anyone that I've ever belonged to in my life. I've never been more at home in a church than I am now. And as I say, the great saving truths of the Revelation that were taught, also taught me along with nonsense about masturbation, are things that I still believe in. I still say the creed and believe it. I still believe in the Trinity and the Incarnation. Those are the things that really matter. And to say that if you disagree with the Pope on contraception, you're not a Catholic, is kind of nonsense. You know, it's small potatoes next to the great truths, the great content of the Revelation, the great message of Scripture. And people of very high standing have been very critical of the popes in the past. John Henry Newman, who later on became Cardinal Newman, is normally considered a pretty good Catholic, actually said, "I hope Pius IX dies soon before he can do more damage to the church." I've not said that, but so Dante, who was a good Catholic, put the Pope in hell, Pope Celestine in hell. I haven't done that. I haven't said that there's any Pope that should be in hell. Of course I can criticize the Pope and be a Catholic.
You're a historian and an intellectual. Does your grounding in history and your questioning mind as an intellectual ever get in the way of faith?
Well, I don't know that I would say get in the way. It makes me constantly question faith. It's not something that's given to you as a child and just you accept it and that's the end. I have to keep probing into what the meaning of the Revelation is. Let me take as an example. It seems to me that reality is one and many. There is no such thing as a one or a many, but we experience in ourselves a oneness and a manyness. That's how Augustine argued to the Trinity. He didn't do it the way the Greek fathers did with metaphysics. He said, how do I experience myself? Because I and my fellow human beings are the closest things to God there could be. We're the highest reality on earth. And so we're taught when we're in catechism class that God is Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Well, God is obviously not Father and Son. He's not male. These are analogs. They are approximations. They are.
You mean God doesn't have a specific gender?
Right. And he doesn't have fatherhood or sonhood or any of those things. He has a relationship with himself that we figure that way. It's what Newman called an economy, that you can't say something directly. You have to say something approximate and get more and more approximate so that God is not man or woman. God is not gendered. God is not of fatherhood or sonhood. But those things help us understand what the kind of intense personal relationship that God has with himself. And so, obviously, there's a feminine component to God. I think that that's indicated by the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, whose actions are kind of maternal and nourishing and warming. The Spirit should not be called it, obviously. I think the Spirit should be called she. But all of those things are adumbrations. They are probes into the mist of the mystery of God. That's all they can be. And it's only wrong to accept these if you consider that they end the mystery, that they perfectly embody the truth. And if you say, for instance, that God is only Father and Son, God is only male, God is only any of those things, he's none of those things, but he's something that we can come toward by thinking of him in those terms provisionally.
My guest is Gary Wills. His new book is called Papal Sin, Structures of Deceit. He's also the author of a biography of St. Augustine. In addition to writing your recent books about religion, you've written a lot over the years, books and articles about American politics in history and present politics. Since you've been writing these books about religion, I'm wondering some of your thoughts about the role religion is playing in the current presidential race. Both presidential candidates have talked about the place of religion in their lives. Is that something you want to hear presidential candidates discuss?
It depends on how it's done. Religion is an extremely important part of American history. There's no modern nation that's as religious as ours is. And of course, I think one of the reasons for that is precisely the separation of church and state. We have given religion a freedom from the bondage that it had to the state under all the preceding polities that I know of. Religion is no longer something that you have to belong to in order to be a citizen. It's not something that promotion in comes from politics or the head of the state or any of those things. So it's been an immensely freeing thing. And so we should have a separation of church and state. On the other hand, it is part of our life, even when it's not a state religion. And there's no way that we can entirely separate it from politics without separating it from morality. Because I used to do an experiment with my students. I would say, how many of you believe in the separation of church and state? And everybody except an occasional Mormon would say, they all did. I said, how many of you believe in the separation of politics and morality? And none of them did. And I said, how many of you think that religion and morality have nothing to do with each other? And none of them thought that either. Obviously, when we make moral choices, many of us, we make them on the basis, in part at least, of the religious tradition we were trained in. Respect for life, duty to the poor, all of those things have a religious element for many of us, if not most of us. And so there's nothing wrong with religion and politics as long as it's not state-recognized, state-establishment religion. It can be exploited, and that's bad, as anything can be exploited, money or celebrity or whatever. But you certainly can't have a ban on religion and politics because the First Amendment allows you to vote and to talk according to whatever your principles are. And if they're religious, then the Constitution guarantees you the right to talk and think and vote in those terms, just so long as you don't have an established religion.
Gary Wills, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Wills is author of the new book, Papal Sin, The Structures of Deceit. Coming up, Tom Maxwell, formerly of the Squirrel Nut Zippers, talks about his first CD as a leader. This is Fresh Air. Tom Maxwell is a former member of the Squirrel Nut Zippers, one of the most popular bands behind what has been described as the neo-swing movement. Maxwell wrote and sang the Zippers' biggest hit, Hell. He left the band last year and has just released his first CD as a leader. It's called Samsara. In addition to featuring new songs inspired by such early jazz performers as Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, and Django Reinhardt, it features a country song by George Jones and a song that features a gospel quartet. Maxwell sings and alternately plays guitar, saxophones, and drums. He also wrote most of the songs on the CD, including this one, Sixes and Sevens to Me. ¶¶
money and two for the show, but that three to get ready won't work no more. When I see that number coming, it's sixes and sevens to me. You can put your loaded dice away, cause for me it's snake eyes all the way. When I see that number coming, it's sixes and sevens to me. Bank account number,
yeah, man.
Telephone number,
no, man.
Waiting line number,
no, man.
You know some things just don't add up. As sure as five will get you ten, I'm going to cross her path again. When I see that number coming, it's sixes and sevens to me.
Music from Tom Maxwell's new CD, Samsara. Tom, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure.
With the Squirrel Nut Zippers, and in part on your new CD, you play what some people would describe as like neo-swing or swing-based music.
Ooh.
Right. I know you feel that way.
Neo
about
swing.
It.
What does that mean?
Yeah. What are some of the problems that you feel you've run into playing a music that a lot of people see as retro?
Well, for one thing, words like retro or nostalgia clinically remove any teeth or soul from the music that you're playing. I'm not a historian. I want to play music that kicks people in the stomach, basically, or affects them on a visceral level. Even if it's incredibly beautiful. So retro means that it's become a figurine that's placed on a shelf that's only brought down to be dusted off. Horrible.
One of the problems I have with the kind of retro approach to jazz is that it requires dressing up. You know, the band and a lot of the audience is expected to dress a certain way and clothes from the past and use a certain language from the past, so it becomes so much about like a costume party instead of just about music.
Yeah, and almost every interview I did regarding the swing movement had nothing to do with what we were doing artistically, and it was all about the associated iconography. Do you wear zoot suits? Do you smoke cigars? Do you drink martinis? And I'm like, look, y'all, what does this have to do with music? I wear jeans and I listen to Beatles records. You know, or Howlin' Wolf records. I didn't understand. It was incredibly frustrating to me. And I also have to say that without naming names, although a lot of very good music was being made by people like Andrew Bird, most of what was held up as being representative of the swing movement was pitifully two-dimensional. It was like a combination of Kansas City jump blues and Gene Krupa backbeats. And I heard endless variations on Sing, Sing, Sing by Benny Goodman. I mean, as an artist, I want to sort of put my own stamp on things and at the same time honor what's come before. It's my job to sort of internalize it and put my own kind of individual stamp on it. I thought the vast majority of so-called swing music was artistically dead on arrival.
Well, listen, before we hear more music from your new record, let me play the song that you're best known for from your days with the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Oh, Paint It Black.
And this is called Hell. It's a calypso.
It's a calypso, yes.
Tell me why you wanted to write a calypso song, how you were introduced to calypso music.
I was coming back from practice when I was a rock and roll drummer, and I was listening to WXYC, the University of North Carolina college radio station, and Seven Skeletons Found in the Yard by Lord Executor came on because it had just been issued from Rounder Records. I was floored because it sounded like he was reading the news, and from what I could make out of the lyrics, it was really, really scary stuff. But the instrumentation was American jazz. It was, you know, clarinet, saxophone, string bass. Very jazz, but the rhythm was, well, it was calypso. How can one describe it? It just had me in its thrall. So I immediately went out and bought that record, and then I was introduced to the Growler and King Radio and Caressor and Tiger and Lion and all these guys. I just love them all. I just love them so much. So I thought, well, heck, calypso is really phenomenal. I need to write a calypso, and I wrote one. It was horrible, just a horrible gloss. And then I wrote another one, and it was Hell.
This is Hell, written by my guest Tom Maxwell from the Squirrel Nut Zippers CD, Hot.
You made an afterlife. You made it up on a serious ride. Now you make the scene.
That's the Squirrel Nut Zippers recording of Hell, a tune written and sung by my guest Tom Maxwell, who has a new CD of his own, which is called Samsara. What music did you grow up listening to?
Small Faces, Beatles, lots and lots of Beatles. See, I heard the Rolling Stones doing Howlin' Wolf before I heard Howlin' Wolf. I wanted to get away from Disco Duck and all the stuff that was on the radio at the time. And my brother was coming home with the canonical British band record collection. So Zeppelin and Stones and stuff, Yardbirds. And then I think in 1988, I was coming home from a gig and I turned on the TV. It was about 2 a.m. and I saw a film clip of Cab Calloway singing Minnie the Moocher very soon after the song was a hit. So he was a young man. It was the early 30s. It was his Cotton Club Orchestra. He was in the White Tails where he's just dynamite. He's so frightening. It's, you know, so unnerving. And he's singing this song, which is about heroin addiction, for crying out loud. It's incredibly sad and menacing. You know, the verses of Minnie the Moocher start with Minnie the Moocher's a nice girl, and then she hooks up with a bad guy who gets her hooked on drugs, and then the last verse is her dreaming about wealth and power. I was like, wow, this band is rocking. These guys are really rocking. And the gal that, with whom I was living at the time had like the Smithsonian History of Jazz, and I played, I heard East St. Louis Toodaloo by Ellington's band, I think the Washingtonians, in about 26. And I thought, how come I never heard this before? Why was all the music from that era that was offered up to people my age incredibly candy-ass and toothless and, nostalgic? This stuff isn't nostalgic. This stuff rocks.
My guest is Tom Maxwell, formerly of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. His first CD as a leader is called Samsara. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Maxwell, formerly of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. He's just released his first CD as a leader. I want to play another track from your new CD, Samsara. And this is a track, and it's a song that you wrote, and you're singing, and accompanying you is someone on pipe organ. Uh-huh. Now, before we hear it, let's talk a little bit about pipe organ and why you wanted the pipe organ backing you up. Fats Waller made some classic recordings with pipe organ. I assume he inspired your choice.
Well, considering I don't think anybody else bothered after Fats to do any jazz pipe organ, those sides just tore me up. They just ripped me up. I knew Fats as a phenomenal piano player and Hammond organist. And then somehow, in Eraserhead all those years ago, that David Lynch movie, they had Fats Waller pipe organ music in it. And I thought, Fats Waller pipe organ, come on, how cool is that? He came up, his dad was a preacher. He used to accompany his father on the sidewalk. He played in the Lincoln and Lafayette theaters in Harlem, backing movies. And then he was a full-on jazz bow. And so when he went into that desanctified church in Camden in 1926, he did first what Ray Charles did many years later, which is to completely synthesize the sacred and the profane. So he's playing St. Louis blues on a pipe organ, or he's playing Beale Street blues with an incredibly terrifying and menacing foot pedal solo on what one normally thinks of as a kind of dull, sanctimonious instrument. And they're very difficult to play. It's like driving a truck playing those things.
Well, why don't we hear the song? This is You'll Always Get What's Coming. My guest Tom Waxwell co-wrote the song. He sings on it, and it's featured on his new CD, Samsara.
Mr. So-and-so's on my mind. He liked to worry me all the time. He can spend his life ducking, dodging, running. Might not get what he wants, but he'll always take what's coming. Oh yeah, now.
That's You'll Always Get What's Coming. My guest Tom Maxwell co-wrote the song. He was also the featured singer on it. It's on his new CD, Samsara. The pipe organ that we heard on there, as you said, you were inspired by Fats Waller's pipe organ playing. Now, I know you tracked down his former guitar player, Al
yes.
Casey.
My friend.
Where did you find him? And
let's see. RCA Bluebird has been steadily reissuing the sides that Fats cut with his band The Rhythm, of which Al was a member. And I just sort of assumed that all those guys were dead. I mean, Fats conked out pretty quick. I read in the liner notes that the guitarist Al Casey was still alive, and Al was the guy on whom I patterned my guitar playing when I came into the Squirrel Nut Zippers. It's like, well, if I'm going to be up front and I'm going to be playing guitar, who do I want to sound like? Well, Al Casey, it was a no-brainer. He's so sweet. His playing is so sweet to me and a little sad and has such a... It's just so great. I just think he's so great. So I'm like, Al Casey's alive. Are you kidding me? I ended up looking him up in the New York directory. Al Casey, you know. And called him on the phone. Hello? Excuse me, are you Al Casey? Yes, I am. Are you the Al Casey that played guitar with Fats Waller? Yes, I am. And can you imagine? I just about jumped out of my clothes. And from there, it was getting his address. He ended up being nice, very nice and solicitous, although I don't think he was used to people calling him up and worshiping him out of the blue. And we went and met him and hung with him, and I've since performed with him, wrote a song about him, performed that song on stage with him, had drinks with him, talked to him about Fats. What a dream come true. I can't tell you.
Did he show you anything nifty on guitar?
No, he says he can't play that chorded style anymore. He started playing single note stuff after the mid-40s when he became amplified. Because in Fats' band, he played, a Gibson L5. He played an acoustic instrument, you know. And he's been playing single note stuff, and he constantly complains about his arthritis, although he plays beautifully. No, but we talked about what kind of strings one would use or the sort of approach one would have. He did bring out his scrapbook, which is like basically this unbelievable history of jazz with signed pictures from, of course, Fats and Armstrong and Holiday, because he took a year off to play in Teddy Wilson's band and back Billie Holiday. I mean, that ain't shabby. And all these guys were friends of his, and that was his life. That's what he did. He's constantly self-deprecating.
Did he ask to hear any of your records?
Yeah, I played him some stuff, but I didn't really pursue him about it because it didn't matter to me whether he liked it or not. It certainly wasn't any basis on which I was going to predicate our relationship. You kidding me? I was thrilled to be around him. So I've never asked him. Although he seemed very, very pleased when I played in Palom with Al. And when we played it together in New York, I burst into tears.
Tom Maxwell, formerly of the Squirrel Nut Zippers, has a new CD called Samsara. Let's listen to Palin with Al, performed by the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
Thank you.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
All the birds up in the trees have got a different song to sing. And it's better now they've learned that swing. They've been prowling without. Below at the candy shop, they're still working at the same old chore. But the stuff is sweeter than it was before. You know why, palin' without. Who's that man that's got the sentimental swing? Plays that mess just like it doesn't mean a thing. Gather round you all and watch him pluck those strings. When he gets the right hand pumping, all his kiddies got to start buck jumping. Listen now and don't forget, if you go for that solid jive, you can always keep the dream alive. Palin, palin, palin with Al.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Crown Division, publishers of The Forest, the novel by Edward Rutherford, author of London and Sarum. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris. Available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Shaft opens this week. On the next Fresh Air, Isaac Hayes, who did the original Shaft theme. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks?
Shaft!
You're damn right.